So,
what's trending?
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to Trending with Timory. Such a blessing to have you here, and what a blessing it is for me. My name is Father Matthew Spencer. I'm the Provincial Superior of the Oblates of St. Joseph in the United States, a province under the protection and intercession of the Holy Spouses, Mary and Joseph. I'm going to be talking about that before the hour is up. Why? Because a very special feast day of the Church that is not nearly as widespread as it needs to be. The Feast of the Holy Spouses, we'll be talking about that very soon. Wow, what a blessing it is to be with you on this very, very historic day in our country, in our nation. I want to talk first about an experience that I had over this weekend. There, it seems like these times of pandemic bring something new every day, some new challenge every hour. And probably you've experienced this. Parents, I know, struggling to know how to educate their kids, whether they move fully to homeschooling, whether they do all online education through their local Catholic school or maybe even a public school. You just get the hang of using whatever digital platform it is, and then before you know it, there's something else thrown into the mix. I know that bishops around the nation struggle because they're trying to adapt to the laws and ordinances of local cities and jurisdictions. So one week they can do Mass inside, and the next week they have to do Mass outside. One week confessions seem to be okay, the next week don't you dare get more people in line than you can reasonably expect to be together. It's hard. We live in difficult times. And here I was, my friends, thinking that I had finally found my groove, finally just arrived at the point of, I don't want to say Zen because I'm Catholic, but peace, right? And acceptance of where we were going with all of this. And I was challenged on that point very significantly just a couple days ago. Here's what happened. I live in beautiful Santa Cruz, California, right on the cliffs, right on the ocean, right on the bay. And it's a gorgeous place to live. The weather is mild. It's very sunny. It's warm. Yes, we get our June gloom, we call it. It's a fog that rolls in some of the summer months that usually burns off midday. But even that makes you more grateful for the sun, makes you more grateful for the blessings of the warmth that come with the sun. We've been doing Mass outside for months now, frankly. I've lost track, as you have in many parts of the world. And it's been okay. Why? In part because the weather's pretty mild. Also because we have a pretty big area that we can fit everybody safely. In this particular jurisdiction where I live, there are no limitations, hard limits on crowd sizes as we come together. So I know that some parts of the country, and especially in California, there are areas where you cannot have more than 100 people together, period. Doesn't matter how much room you have, doesn't matter how much space each person can have, it's just the size of the crowd that matters. Well, that's not a limitation that we have. So we've been outside, it's been pretty mild, and we've been able to accommodate everybody, and that's a blessing. And then, of course, probably 2 months ago, we started to have our first rains. And so we put up these large tents. And they're not perfect, don't get me wrong. They're more like shade coverings. They're angled roofs, so the rain runs off of them, and they're waterproof tarps on top. But they're definitely not perfect. And I know that those really courageous people that come, rain or shine, would tell me that they're not perfect. But that's okay. People are grateful. They tell me they're grateful for it. And I'm really happy that people have been coming to Mass despite all this. So I'm just setting this up for you. We've been outside. We have a bunch of tents in our parking lot. They're large. They're probably 20 feet by 30 feet kind of tents. So this Sunday, we heard we were going to have a windstorm coming on Monday. And I thought, okay, what's the right way to handle this? See, I know what wind is like on the ocean. I've lived here for a while, and I know more or less what these tents can take. They've been around for a couple months. And so in our planning, we said, well, okay, Monday night, we're going to batten down these tents a little more carefully. We're going to actually take the legs off of them and put them on the ground. We're going to eliminate as much wind resistance and effect that the wind can have on these tents as possible. I thought that was a decent idea. One of the brothers of mine thought of that. And then we attached these massive, well, not massive, they're buckets, 5 gallon, 3 gallon, 5 gallon buckets full of water sealed. So they probably weigh 30 pounds each, and we roped them all down all around these large tents. It sounds to me, as somebody who doesn't live through hurricanes and tornadoes, it sounds perfectly reasonable. You can tell where this is going. Can you tell where this is going? Monday night, we expect the winds to pick up around 10:30 p.m. So by 9 o'clock, we're good to go. I'm in my office. I have a view of the parking lot where the tents are set up, but more importantly, I can hear the wind, and it's a gentle breeze. 10:30 comes and no breeze, and 11 o'clock comes around and it's very quiet. And I'm thinking, all this work we did for nothing? And now I have to go put all these tents back together, put them up. Well, I was working late into the night on Monday, and by midnight, all of a sudden, I lifted my head up from looking at my laptop, and I said, that was a strong gust of wind. And all of a sudden, I realized that this wind was stronger and had picked up quite a bit in the last few minutes. So I throw on my shoes, run outside, and I look, and how can I describe this? The tents had become like the Pacific Ocean. They were undulating up and down in a wave type of fashion. Imagine these two tents strapped together, about 30 feet long each, so about 60 feet long, 20 feet wide, and it's going up and down by about 4 or 5 feet maybe from the parking lot floor, and it's lifting up these massive buckets of water, and I'm thinking, my goodness, I do not weigh enough to jump on top of those tents and hold them down. I'm also a little bit concerned about flying away with those tents. I dash over to the front of our shrine where we have a little pop-up tent that covers our altar, which is also outside. And this is when I knew that I was way in over my head. I decide it's time to take this pop-up tent down, which we thought was perfectly safe, also being weighted down, also under an alcove next to the church, right next to the entrance. I reach up. This is, you're not going to believe me, Patrick, Lucas, Karen, everybody out there listening, you're going to think I'm exaggerating, but I tell you, this is what happened. I reached up. There's a latch on the top of the underside of the tent, which disengages the locking mechanism and allows it to very quickly fold up. When I say pop-up tent, I'm talking about one of those small pop-up tents you can take to the park, 10 feet by 10 feet, more or less, right? You take it to the beach and relax. And I reach up to pop it and drop it down. And the wind comes at that very moment. I wish I flew. I wish, Karen says, you flew away. I wish. I should have grabbed onto it and just flown away like the wind. I didn't think that far ahead. Well, I would have missed it anyway. The wind picked up the tent. I would guess it went up straight into the air about 12 feet. And now that I'm describing this, I'm surprised it didn't occur to me at the time that it could have just come crashing down on me. It didn't, thanks be to God. It went straight up, and for just a brief instant, I was underneath this tent in awe at the power of the wind and the fear and trepidation of the possibilities before me hadn't quite hit me yet. And the tent is carried just very lightly, maybe 3 or 4 feet to my right, and then it slams down onto the ground, and it completely misses me. Thanks be to God. But do you know what it doesn't miss? is a huge statue of the Holy Family, which is right at the entrance of our shrine. And almost in horror, I look and I think, not the statue. Better that it had come down on Father Matthew, right? Not really. I'm not really. I know that. I'm just thinking at the moment, not being able to keep up my mind intellectually. I see it crash down on the statue. But wouldn't you know it? I mean, it's a minor miracle, it seems to me. Not a scratch on that statue, which is made of wood, by the way. This is not like a strong, concrete, indestructible type of statue. What had happened is the pop-up tent came crashing down over that statue, tore through the roof, the statue did, which is just made out of a light fabric, and the frame completely missed it. I have a picture of it. I should have thought to tweet it out. Maybe at one of our breaks, I'll tweet it out and show you a picture of this tent frame completely destroyed around a Holy Family statue. And it looks like it was put there because I took the picture in the morning rather than the night of. Just at that moment, grateful that the statue was spared, I realized the wind could do that same thing again any moment. And the right solution here, it occurred to me, is to very quickly remove what made it possible for the wind to catch that tent. That is, remove the roof of that tent. So that's what I did. I really quickly ripped it off. It was already ripped through by the Holy Family statue. It was not too hard. Pulled it off, and then the Holy Family statue was safe. And then I remembered the huge undulating wave right behind me that's about to crash through the stained glass windows of our shrine. Mind you, this is midnight. There's not a soul around. And if I had been smart about it, I would have called for backup. I would have gotten my brothers out of bed there in our religious house. I hadn't thought that far ahead, and who knows if they would have even gotten there, you know, down there in time, because it all happened so quickly. So here's where I did something a little bit dangerous. Again, no harm done to me. Thanks be to God. I'm fine. I decided I better grab that big tent that's about to fly off and float into the sea. And I grabbed it with one hand right in the middle, imagining, can you imagine this? Imagining that finally my weight and my strength would be able to hold it down. And God chuckled, of course, because the wind was far stronger than Father Matthew at that moment. There's a homily in there, I know. I at that moment, when I grasped onto that tent, I realized that this was a very dangerous endeavor that I had gotten myself involved in. I realized that just as that small little tent had flown up and crashed down, I was right in the middle of a very problematic situation which could cause loss of life or limb to yours truly. Of course, that doesn't really stop me. It's just my lack of common sense or thinking things through, or maybe it's my trust in God and my guardian angel. First and foremost on my mind was making sure that nobody else got hurt, was that our shrine didn't get destroyed and hurt. I very quickly, and it only took a few minutes, I went around and I detached the tarp from the top of that, these huge tarps. And then all of a sudden the frames were down, the tarps were practically blown away completely by the wind, but caught on to a few of the buckets there. And then over the next 15 minutes, I just slowly would wait for a lull in the wind, roll up as much as I could, 5 feet of the tent. And then, imagine this, the wind would pick back up and I would fall and lay down on the tarp for a moment. Oh, someday, when you're in heaven, please God, you and I will be in heaven together. We'll be able to rewind history, look back at these catastrophic and yet comical moments in our lives, and we'll be able to chuckle about them then. It's still a little too raw. It's a little too fresh for me to talk about in the same way. But by 12:30 a.m., on Tuesday morning, everything was safely put away. And the tents are going to be reconstructed, not too much damage, a few poles that need to be removed. I know these winds, people tell me, everybody tells me, Father, this is very extraordinary. Don't worry, these are not coming back. And I say, well, then you put up the tents. Then you take care of the tents, because I really don't want that to happen again. No, we're going to put up the tents so that our people are comfortable and coming back to Mass and able to be protected from the elements. You're listening to Trending with Timory. I'm Father Matthew Spencer. Really glad to be with you. I'm telling you this story about my Tuesday morning, because of what happened over the next hour or so. Of course, my mind is racing. And all of a sudden, I was overwhelmed with this temptation to give up. Frankly, I don't know how else to describe it, where you feel like you've just had too much. Have you been through that experience before, where you just feel like you can't do it anymore? You've done enough. And I think a lot of us have reached this point multiple times through the pandemic. I know that myself in my ministry during the pandemic, we're asked to do more difficult and more difficult things. All of us are. And I do them, or I begin to do them, and I think, I just can't do this. This is too much. Why do I keep doing this? Why do we keep having to do this? And we want to rebel. We want to give up. We want to throw in the towel, whatever it is. And that's for the next, I don't know if it was an hour, but I couldn't get to sleep immediately because I was just thinking about how all this was going to affect our ability to serve the people of God. I just was overwhelmed by this temptation to not persevere, as if a small, tiny windstorm is enough to break my spirit. Now, in retrospect, I think back and that is what made me give up. I mean, those few moments, that's what's going to make me quit? No, of course not. And now in retrospect, I can say that. But isn't it interesting how we reach the breaking point in our lives, in our worldly challenges, in our relationship difficulties, in our spiritual life? We will reach the what we believe is the edge of our limits. And we experience a temptation to give up. And these are the moments, my friends. These are the times when we must turn to Scripture. We must turn to our faith. We must turn to our tradition, to turn to those foundational values that we have. Do you remember that parable that Jesus gives us of the persistent woman and the judge? And it's a parable of perseverance. Or maybe you remember Romans 3, which is certainly a favorite passage of mine, especially verses 3 to 5. St. Paul says, not only do we boast of our afflictions, we even boast of our afflictions, he says, knowing that affliction produces what? Perseverance or endurance. Endurance, proven character, and proven character, hope. And hope does not disappoint. In other words, how do we ever expect to get to the hope that we want to have and want to live in our life if we don't also experience affliction? Hope is not made in times of comfort and in luxury. Hope does not come about because our lives are functioning perfectly. Hope springs forth indirectly through affliction. St. Paul says, affliction produces endurance, endurance or perseverance produces character, proven character produces hope. And this is partly what the Christian life is about. I really believe that during this time of a pandemic, during these times of challenges in our lives, and I mean, let's face it, your difficulties surpass even a pandemic that the world is experiencing, because you have your particular difficulties that you're facing. Maybe your own loved ones are experiencing great crisis and difficulty. Maybe your business has gone completely upended because of the pandemic. Maybe your retirement funds have been exhausted trying to get through this time. And maybe you think that you're at the limits of what you can take. Maybe you believe that you've arrived and there's just no more you can do. It's just time to give up. It's time to throw in the towel. And this is what I want to say to you. Don't do it. Don't do it. Because in retrospect, 3 months from now, 6 months from now, a year from now, you're going to look back at this and you're going to say, oh yeah, it was a windstorm. It was scary. It was difficulty. And maybe it was even dangerous. But it wasn't the end of the world. And in hindsight, that is not going to be what finally does me in. And that's what you and I are going to come to the realization of, I hope. What will it be that finally makes us reach the limits of our perseverance? I think that's unique for each of God's creatures. It's unique, but we haven't yet arrived at the point, as we read in Scripture, of shedding our blood. We haven't yet arrived at the point of martyrdom. The Catechism in 1816 says, the disciple of Christ must not only keep the faith and live on it, but also profess it. Right? When you and I, through our affliction, learn perseverance and endurance, when we're shaped in character, when that character then creates the possibility of hope within us, it makes it possible for us to confidently bear witness to what we believe, that windstorms, pandemics, illness, crises, these things cannot take away our hope, and they cannot take away what you and I know to be true, that Jesus Christ is still with us, and Jesus Christ is still in control. Don't give up, my friends. I know, maybe you're struggling, and maybe you're having a hard time persevering. And maybe you've arrived at a point, maybe much more significant than the small anecdote I was sharing with you about Monday night. Maybe you've arrived at the point where it's just finally all you can do or all you think you can do. And that's the time when you need to return to the Lord, return to the source of your hope, and renew your efforts to follow Christ unreservedly. I'm Father Matthew Spencer, sitting in for Timmery. I'll be back right after this.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timmery on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Welcome back to Trending with Timmery. Father Matthew Spencer, happy to sit in for Timmery. And I heard that Timmery is going to be back behind this microphone on Friday. Lucas, can you confirm that? Is that true?
That is true.
Wow, that's awesome. We sure missed her. Yeah.
She's going to pop on Friday and kind of do a special episode to talk about Roe v. Wade, with that being the anniversary. So it should be really good.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, I'm really excited to listen to her. Until then, I'm very happy to be with you for a short time today and to help sit in for Timmery while she's on maternity leave. Maybe you've heard of the term cognitive reappraisal. It's a phrase from psychology. If you've studied psychology, you know what this is. Maybe even if you've been to therapy, you've heard this idea. But all of us know deep down what this is about. The idea of cognitive reappraisal is that we use our emotions to reframe, or we use our intellect, I should say, to reframe emotional experiences or difficult situations we've had. And we see them from a different perspective is basically what it means, right? It's a fancy term that describes looking back at past experiences and seeing them anew, reappraising them, essentially. It's a very effective tool that psychologists and therapists will use to help you handle a lot of traumatic situations in your past, a lot of difficult experiences you might have gone through. I was reading some research from recent weeks that was published. This in particular is from the University of Illinois that was published just a couple weeks ago, January 8th, that was noticing the similarities between religion and psychology when it comes to this emotion regulation strategy of cognitive reappraisal. I was chuckling a little bit at this article because one of the scientists interviewed said, it appears that religious people are making use of some of the same tools that psychologists have systematically identified as effective in increasing well-being and protecting against distress. And I wanted to say, wait, let's rephrase this. It appears that psychologists are acknowledging what religious people have known for thousands of years, that reframing our experience and seeing it anew helps us to process them. But I don't want to nitpick here because the deep down, what these particular researchers are pointing out is that there is a lot of common ground between religion and science. That's what they're saying, essentially, that religion has been helping people go through cognitive reappraisal processes for a long time, to be able to look at the bad experiences that have happened to them and to see them through the eyes of God, see them with meaning, with understanding. And now the science backs that up, right? Scientific evidence that we have shows that that is helpful for, we know, not only the human psyche, but also the human spirit. So that's good news. And I'm grateful for that. I think sometimes people look at religion as just a psychological tool and think that somehow we're psyching ourselves out with it. And that's where I'd probably disagree with some of the researchers of this data, because you and I know that religion is about much more than simply cognitive reappraisal. We don't just look back at our life and reinvent something or try and reframe it in a way that isn't consistent with the experience we had in the past, but rather is a way of seeing it through the lens, a more objective lens. For example, seeing our sufferings through the lens of God, through the eyes of God. Seeing the trauma that we've gone through the mercy and grace that God can provide us in those trying times of ours. So when you are approaching the sacraments, when you are approaching the Lord, don't shy away from this very important aspect of our faith where we look back at what we've gone through. Ignatius of Loyola would call this an examen, but all throughout history, especially in our Christian tradition, we've had the important practice of reflecting on our life, reflecting on our day, reflecting on our past sins even, and looking at them through the eyes of our merciful God. And it helps us. It helps us to understand those experiences better, and it helps us to know what God's will is for us in the present. And science backs that up. I mentioned, switching gears a little bit here, I mentioned a few moments ago about the patrons, saints of the province that I belong to. So I'm an oblate of St. Joseph. We're a small religious community. We were founded by a saint, St. Joseph Morello, who lived in the 19th century. He brought together these four young men, and he said, I really see that God is working in you, that you all are attracted to this life of hard work, of service, of humble, hidden service to the Lord through a consecrated life. And so he formed the Congregation of the Oblates of St. Joseph. And it started with those four men, and now is about 650 men around the world, who are trying to serve the church in imitation of St. Joseph. And during our history, we have always had a great devotion to St. Joseph, but also we've had a great devotion to our Blessed Mother. And this is really important and special in our own times, I think, our founder really looked to Mary and Joseph as models, as examples, as these paragons of holiness that you and I can look to, learn from, and imitate. And we know from, because we're good Josephologists, that Joseph was most likely a young man. And therefore, we contemplate and think about the fact that he and our Blessed Mother were betrothed, were married, and would later come to live together, all according to Jewish custom, and that this vocation of theirs as a couple is important in the salvation history, is important not only for forming the Holy Family, not only for giving an example to Jesus, but also of reminding us, even now, 2,000 years later, what marriage is all about. Did you know that prior to the Second Vatican Council and the reform of the liturgy at the Second Vatican Council, there was a feast in the church, a relatively minor feast, called the espousals of Joseph and Mary. And it was a feast that started in the 15th century. I think it was Jean Gerson, who at a particular council of the church approached the Pope and said, look, it's really important. There's these priests who have started to experience this devotion to pray votive masses in honor of Mary and Joseph, and I think we should spread this particular devotion. And over the following centuries, little by little, that particular devotion to Mary and Joseph as a couple became an important part of various congregations in the church, and even is entered into the official missal of the church. And very sadly, in my opinion, at the reforms of the liturgy in the 60s and 70s, the church decided to not include the Feast of the Espousals in the current missal. And because of that, people hear about the Feast of the Holy Spouses and they scratch their head because, well, we've never heard of that. We've heard of Christmas. We've heard of March 19th, the Feast of St. Joseph. We've heard of the Annunciation. We've heard of the Assumption. We've heard of Our Lady of Sorrows, maybe. We've heard of the Immaculate Conception. We've heard of St. Joseph the Worker. We've heard of a lot of different feast days independent of one another, of Mary and Joseph. But there is a special feast day that the church historically has had for many centuries that now is not very common. So, after the reform of the liturgy, my congregation said, wait a second, that feast was really important. And so they went to the Vatican. We went to the Vatican. I wasn't quite born yet, but we went to the Vatican and we said, is it possible for us to reintegrate, reincorporate this feast day inside of our own liturgical calendar? And maybe I could put this inside of into context for you. Every religious community, Franciscans, Jesuits, Dominicans, they all have the possibility of having special feast days. Maybe it's the feast day of their founder. Maybe it's the feast day of not very well-known saints that were part of their community, and so they venerate them in a very special way. Well, in the case of my community, we were given special permission. I actually think it came in the 80s, if I recall correctly, for us to celebrate the feast of the Holy Spouses, Mary and Joseph. And what day does that fall on? Traditionally, it falls on January 23rd, coming up this Saturday this year, which is why it's on my mind quite a bit. What is very fascinating to me is that this feast day is so close to this infamous anniversary that we as Americans see pass by us every year. The terrible tragedy of the liberalization of abortion and access to abortion through Roe v. Wade, which happened on January 22nd, of course. And every time this year comes around, and every time I see the marches and the walks on both coasts, I know not really happening in the same way this year. Every time that we're experiencing and praying for the repeal of all these heinous heinous possibilities of death inside of our country, I can't help but notice that God gave to the church this very special feast day of the Holy Spouses right at the same time. The day after this terrible memory that we have of Roe v. Wade, God invites some small congregations around the world to celebrate the Feast of the Holy Spouses. For some time, my congregation has been petitioning bishops, has been talking to their local chanceries, has been writing letters and saying, you know, this would be a really good feast day to incorporate inside of your diocese. This would be a really good feast day to spread and share with the world. Certainly for couples, for husbands and wives. Certainly for those who are engaged. But it's not only for husbands and wives, and it's not only for engaged couples. The Feast of the Holy Spouses is a reminder of the great betrothal between Jesus and his church, as every marriage is, right? Every marriage is a pointer to this intimate communion and union that God desires with his holy people. I hope, and I still pray, that more and more bishops will begin to see the value of this feast day that once was celebrated very commonly, right up until a few decades ago, that now is not so common and yet is possible because bishops have the authority to change their liturgical calendars, to incorporate feasts that are consistent with our tradition. There is a complication to this inside of the United States that I'm acutely aware of. There are other optional memorials inside of the United States on January 23rd. And we don't want to eclipse any saints that way, right? But there's got to be a way that we can resolve this. Maybe the Feast of the Holy Spouses gets moved around and bumped around to a different day. Maybe the optional memorials of those other saints get moved around. This is not a difficult thing to solve, and certainly within the realm of possibilities. But hopefully, maybe even our bishops' conference inside of the U.S. can take this up and say, this would be important, and this would be very special. This is something that our society needs right now. It needs an example of holy matrimony. It needs an example of husbands and wives that are faithful to the end in their marriage vows, as Joseph and Mary were. And I think that bishops would experience the great graces that would come with the implementation of this feast in their diocese. Of course, who am I to tell bishops what to do? But I do believe that there's something really special that God is doing in our times. Right now, we're in the middle of this very blessed year of St. Joseph, which is still just kind of, I'm riding high on this beautiful opportunity to share our spirituality of St. Joseph that you have embraced, I know, that you love, I know, but that so many others could benefit from. Well, along with this year of St. Joseph is the reminder that Joseph was the husband of Mary. That's his principal title. That's the title that we celebrate on March 19th, his principal feast day, St. Joseph, husband of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And it's that title that I think the world needs to be reminded of and is especially emphasized too in the Feast of the Holy Spouses. So may God help us to restore holy matrimony in our society and in the world. And may we always look to Joseph and Mary to do that. I'm Father Matthew Spencer, really happy to be with you and sitting in for Timory for this hour. I'll be back right after this.
We're talking about what you're thinking about. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Welcome back to Trending with Timory. It's Father Matthew Spencer. Happy to be with you for just a few more minutes remaining in this hour. Lucas was asking me at the break there if I had grown up in California. And I said, yeah, I grew up in San Diego, actually. And then I lived all around the state of California. Then he said, so were you ever a Chargers fan? And I said, Of course I was a Chargers fan. Growing up, I was a Chargers fan, diehard. Even after I had moved away from San Diego and really stopped following football for that matter, I just was always rooting for the Chargers. And then the Chargers moved to Los Angeles, and I became very bitter. I don't know why, because I had not been following. I'm not a big football fan and wasn't really following them. It just felt like a betrayal. And sports fans know this, right? You know, because you become attached to not only your team, but the whole history of your team and their connection to your perceived city of origin. I know that our city of origin is the city of God, is why I say that. But I can't help but always have been edified by Philip Rivers there with him, and just because of his faith, right? Because of his love for the Catholic Church, that was always to me so edifying. I was very, very excited to him to hear the news after, I think, was it just one season with the Colts? Now he's going to be retiring. He just announced today, I believe. And so I'm very happy for him. He's got a huge family, tons of kids. He's got a ton of work in being a father for all those kids. And I'm sure that's what he wants to focus on nowadays. I'm just so glad that we have these, I'm not trying to canonize them. And if you're listening, you know, Mr. Rivers, I'm not trying to say that you've made it yet. You're not, because none of us have, you know, but it is so helpful to see people that are really in the spotlight, that really get a lot of media attention, that are doing jobs that people around the world will look to, that have no Christian background will look to. And for us to be able to share our faith in those contexts, to say there doesn't have to be a division between living a holy life in society on the one hand, and also engaging in that society. These are beautiful things that all of us are called to do as Christians, right? So all the best to Mr. Rivers there. I want to turn to today's gospel passage, which to me was really powerful. Let's read Mark 3, 1 through 6, if we could. Jesus entered the synagogue, Mark writes. There was a man who had a withered hand. They, meaning the Pharisees, watched Jesus closely to see if he would cure him on the Sabbath so that they might accuse him. He said to the man with the withered hand, "Come up here before us." Then he said to the Pharisees, "Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath rather than to do evil, to save life rather than to destroy it?" But they remained silent, looking around at them with anger and grieved at their hardness of heart. Jesus said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately took counsel with the Herodians against him to put him to death. This gospel passage really struck me for a few reasons. The first that really, really stands out to me is Jesus' reaction to the Pharisees. Jesus, who knows that he's being watched, he's being scrutinized, he's being judged, and they're waiting to trip him up or for him to make a mistake. He knows it. He knows it very well, because this is how they've always approached Jesus' ministry. And he asks them, even before express their objections and accuse him of something, even before any of that, he says to them, "Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath rather than to do evil, to save life rather than to destroy it?" And they have no answer to it, or at least they remain silent. I hope that they have no answer to it, and that's why they remain silent, rather than simply, you know, out of pure obstinacy, not responding to Jesus. But of course, it doesn't matter. Either way, Jesus is angered in this moment. Of course, righteous anger that Jesus experiences. And he grieves also in this response, which to me is very powerful. On the one hand, he's angry at their obstinacy, and he's angry at their their complete adherence to the letter of the law without caring for the good of the man right before them. But he's also grieved at their inability to accept what he's come to proclaim. He's grieved, Scripture says, at their hardness of heart. He's sad for them. Why? Because who's missing out in this interaction? It's not Jesus. And it's not the man with a withered hand. It's the Pharisees. They're the ones missing out on this huge opportunity to experience the divine, to be transformed by this miracle they're about to see. But they don't. They're planning his death. And they're taking counsel with the Herodians in order to put Jesus to death. It's a powerful lens, a powerful look into the heart of the Pharisees. And I would say not only the heart of the Pharisees, but also what happens when you and I become obstinate, when you and I put human laws above God's law, when we limit God's mercy because of our petulance, because of our own envy and jealousy, because whatever it is, right? When you and I don't want good to happen to other people, when we become Pharisaical, the Lord is angered and yet grieves at the hardness of heart that we find. And we use those words, obviously, as an analogy. God doesn't get emotional in the sense that that you and I would describe anger and grief. But on the other hand, he wants our conversion. He wants us to be merciful and loving with the same heart that he extends to you and to me. And it's so hard for us. We end up just holding on to our own perspective, to our own hardness of heart, how important it is for us to allow God to soften our hearts. But here's the other aspect of this that I found maybe that was very pointed for me and maybe for you too. And that is the Pharisees were there waiting to accuse Jesus. Mark says that, right? They watched Jesus closely, he writes, to see if he would cure the man on the Sabbath so that they might accuse him. They were so concerned about catching Jesus in an act of, say, blasphemy or disobedience to the law. They were so concerned about catching him and accusing him that they missed the whole opportunity of being channels and instruments of God's merciful grace. Does that sound familiar? I mean, you and I can fall into that same trap where we look around at others and instead of desiring conversion, transformation, healing, restoration for them, we end up wanting to accuse them. We end up wanting to judge them. We end up wanting to cast stones at them, to take the place of God. And who loses out in that situation? We do. When you and I choose to accuse and take the role of accuser, then we're missing out on the possibility of being an instrument of grace and of healing and of conversion, of transformation for others. I couldn't help but think about the fact that one of the titles of the evil one is the accuser. Right? I mean, this is a title that comes from the Old Testament that you and I are reminded of, that the evil one loves to accuse us before God, loves to point out our failings and our faults, loves to point out how where we should be judged, where we're not worthy of mercy. And he does this for a variety of reasons, but especially to try and break our spirit, especially for us to start experiencing that negative perspective ourselves. Say, well, yeah, I am a pretty bad person. Why should I keep trying to move on? Why should God forgive me? How much the evil one loves to accuse us. When we fall into that same habit, who are we imitating? Not Jesus. Who is the judge? Who has the right to accuse? And who has the ability to know the hearts of all those that he's judging and to judge them rightly? Instead, when you and I take on the role of accuser, we are more clear. We are more closely imitating the evil one rather than imitating Jesus. That's the magnitude of this erroneous behavior in our life. And so how important it is, I believe, for us to recognize those times when we're apt to, when we're want to accuse others, when we try to catch people in their sin or in their brokenness or in their woundedness. Instead of taking the place of the accuser, why don't we take the place of Jesus? Why don't we see ourselves in Jesus, desiring healing for others, desiring restoration for others, desiring mercy, so that others might be healed and come to know God? Okay, have a blessed evening. Thanks so much for joining me. Again, can't wait to have Timory back on Friday. But until then, may Almighty God bless you, the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit.